You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
We're sponsored this week by Decode DC, the podcast that gives you an honest look into how politics affects your life. The host of Decode DC, Jimmy Williams. You got to hear this guy. He's worked in politics on both sides of the aisle. He's worked as a lobbyist. And he knows his stuff. He's talking about all that experience, and he's explaining how things really work inside and outside of Washington. Decode DC is a smart, surprising, and it challenges the conventional wisdom. Like in their recent episodes that deal with every type of issue in and outside of the campaign, you can imagine. It's a really good podcast. I've had an opportunity to check it out a couple of times. Check it out today. I think you'll love it. Decode DC, available on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 3rd, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, well, guest just fell through a couple minutes before the show, so it will be me and us holding it down, talking about the big news of the day. Columbia, by less than a percentage point, rejects a peace deal with the FARC guerrillas. What comes next and what led up to that failed referendum? Talk about that. Donald Trump, his tax secrets have been revealed to the New York Times, and he has, well, frankly, he's been avoiding paying taxes. Big leak. Big leak. I mean, look, I don't know whether to brag about how smart I am for defrauding the government or to rage impotently. I think I'll do all of the above. And I'll send my surrogates out, too. It'll be great. And Barack Obama reflects on his legacy, talking with Jonathan Chait, New York Magazine, about the stimulus, about how Washington works, and when he realized once and for all that Republicans really were out to get him and couldn't be compromised or negotiated with recently, really, even though he would actually still like nothing more. Conciliatory centrist guy to the end. Leaked audio finds Hillary Clinton hugging every piece of the political spectrum, every space in the political spectrum possible, and referring to Bernie Sanders supporters as basement dwellers. Could be that some of them were basement dwellers because of the neoliberal economic policies that she and her husband help usher through. So, not a good look. But we will go to a wiser voice than Hillary Clinton to contextualize those remarks in the election. Bernie Sanders himself. That and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Everything is going wrong. I had a guest. Something came up last minute, so I literally got the text that wasn't going to happen. Right before we were starting, and now we're going to have to deal with this in the break. There's something wrong with getting into the phone system. So things are stacked against us today, folks, but we will persevere. Now, I want to actually get to these two stories first. We should talk about Columbia. So there has been a civil war in Colombia, and really a multifaceted war in Colombia, going on for decades, specifically the FARC has been engaged in armed insurgency since at least the early 70s. It's a war that has killed, and this is certainly not just on the FARC at all, because there's also been a paramilitary response to the FARC. There's been a governmental response to the FARC that has displaced, just conservatively, I'm going to actually get these numbers. They're right in front of me. But it's basically killed a couple of hundred thousand people and displaced, I believe, over a million others in this fighting. And, you know, the FARC has maintained itself as this guerrilla insurgency at a time when many other groups with similar political profiles have sort of collapsed in Latin America. And that's been the case for a number of reasons. One, it's because the FARC is incredibly well organized and very effective. Two, it's because they've been able to, you know, move into cocaine business and give themselves some real, you know, cash reserves and currency. And they've also obviously sustained some support and connection with governments like the, you know, Chavez government, Chavista government in Venezuela, the support from Cuba. Now, President Santos, the current president of Colombia, is a center-right leader who represents and comes from very old money in Colombia. But he's also someone who's concerned about Colombia's sort of brand image and its process of industrialization and development. So he succeeded a guy named Álvaro Uribe, who was the president before, who was a hard far-right leader who came from a sort of new emerging bourgeoisie in Colombia, a lot of money in cattle, in real estate, and also in narco trafficking, and extremely right-wing and supporters of paramilitaries. And that's the world that he comes from. And that world of ranching, cocaine, money, weapons, paramilitaries, politics, the Colombian military is very amorphous and kind of bleeds together. Now, he was intensely opposed to Santos's peace deal with the FARC. And I think Santos's perspective is, one, it's a humanitarian catastrophe, obviously. Two, it's not going to be ended militarily, and that is been sort of relentlessly demonstrated. And three, it's better overall for the stability and development of Colombia and the sort of interest that he represents for Colombia to be stabilized. So he negotiated this deal. It was closely conducted with the Cubans, and it went to referendum. And I guess, you know, it's different. You know, I don't know what the polling looked like going into it, but it seemed like a sort of similar thing to Brexit, where, you know, a lot of people assumed that it would just pass. It wouldn't be a problem. There was even a quote that I read from a no voter who said that he was actually shocked that the deal didn't go through. There was very low voter turnout. There were weather problems, there was regulatory, there were weather problems and other sort of problems with the mechanics of getting people out, and it was rejected by less than half a percentage point. The leader of the FARC, Timoshenko, as he's known, and President Santos say that they're going to keep working towards peace and they're going to uphold the ceasefire, although obviously this is a major setback. You know, the couple of reasons that have been presented as to why this is rejected, and I'll just sort of run through them. One, and this has happened in previous Colombian disarmament agreements with groups, with paramilitaries and other militarized organizations. You have a leadership of the FARC that clearly has the ability to go into politics and, you know, build bases of support and kind of transition from being guerrillas to political leaders. But you have thousands of trained guerrilla fighters who've spent their whole lives doing this. And the question becomes, what happens with these people? And in previous agreements, when certain groups have been demilitarized, you know, people have just sort of transitioned into working either for drug cartels or becoming hired assassins. So there might have been some worry. And the FARC, though, in its very tight organizational discipline, has been in its own internal process and education, actually training people and training out their fighters from the transition to guerrilla to political force. And obviously, that's a risk, but it's better than actual sort of hot warfare. Number two is a lot of residual and justified anger. I mean, be real, all of these groups have committed a lot of atrocities, and that certainly includes the FARC. And connected with that was complaints about, you know, things that are maybe more symbolic, but I guess you can't judge unless you've been on the other side of them. But like the FARC's refusal to apologize for certain human rights abuses and kidnappings. All of the main stakeholders say that they are going to continue this process, the leadership of the FARC, President Santos, although his term ends in 2018. And of course, there's immense support from the international community and the United Nations. So we'll dig into this more. We'll get a guest on it. But that's the lay of the land for now. And speaking of lay of the land, I've not worn a watch for years. But I do think, like, it's a classy move. They look cool. And I am actually pretty excited by this brand new sponsor we have, Movement Watches. The company was started by two broke college kids that wanted to wear stylish watches but couldn't afford them, so they started their own watch company. It's a lot like, you know, a lot of projects have started in this world of podcasting and YouTube and new media. You have a desire to do something. There isn't the sort of incumbent interest to set you up, so you go and start on your own. It's a cool story. Movement watches start at just $95 at a department store, and you're looking if you're at a department store, you're going to be looking at it between $400 to $500. Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. Classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism. Over 500 watches sold in 160 countries. And here's the special deal for Majority Report people. Get 15% off of Movement Watch today with free shipping and free returns by going to MVMT. That's MVMT. We'll have a link on the website. Watches.com/majority. This watch has a great design, and I'm looking forward. I really want one. Now is time to step up your watch game. Step up your game in general. Go to MVMTwatches.com/majority. That's MVMTwatches.com/majority. Join the movement. Okay. Speaking of movement, Bernie Sanders started one in his run for the Democratic primary. He, as we've said many times on this show, and certainly as I've said in many different outlets, spoke to the core issues and, you know, outlined an agenda that's the future. And if we're going to have a sort of viability in the 21st century, we're going to have to implement a lot of his program on addressing the crisis of inequality, on serious financial reform. And there is no doubt that the best way to support that process is to elect Hillary Clinton president. And we will keep having that argument. But we have some new leaked audio, which we do need to address, of Hillary Clinton. You know, we have the basement dweller nonsense, which, you know, again, it's a stupid comment. There's nothing to defend about it. But if you stuck a microphone around any of us in private conversations, you'd find a lot of stupid comments. And I'll leave it at that. But let's get to this audio. This is also leaked audio from the same sort of batch that's been leaked by The Intercept of Hillary Clinton speaking at a fundraiser. She describes some progressive goals as quote-unquote unrealistic, and she describes where she stands politically. I don't think that we're going to discover anything new or nefarious in this, and that's why I want us to take a listen.
It is important to recognize what's going on in this election. Everybody who's ever been in any election that I'm aware of is quite bewildered because there is a strain of, on the one hand, a kind of populist, nationalist, xenophobic, discriminatory kind of approach that we hear too much of from the Republican candidates. And on the other side, there's just a deep desire to believe that, you know, we can have free college, free health care, that what we've done hasn't gone far enough and we just need to, you know, go as far as, you know, Scandinavia, whatever that means. And half the people don't know what it means, but it
would mean going farther towards policies that have worked in Scandinavia. Not rocket science, very lame laugh line. Go ahead.
Is something that they deeply feel. So as a friend of mine said the other day, I am occupying from the center left to the center right, and I don't have much company there because it is difficult when you're running to be president and you understand how hard the job is. I don't want to overpromise. I don't want to tell people things that I know we cannot do. I want to level with the American people and be very clear about the progress I think we can make. Now, it won't surprise any of you to hear me say that I think we can grow the economy, get back to more broad-based, inclusive prosperity. We did it in the 90s. We saw the results of having not only a lot of jobs, but incomes rise.
Okay, so, you know, a couple points to make here. One, we're just going to relitigate things that we already know we disagree with. I've never said for a moment that in electing Hillary Clinton president, we're not electing a great progressive reformer. We know that. Now, the distinctions to make are, number one, parties and structure matter a lot. The modern configuration of the Democratic Party is significantly more to the left, and that means that Hillary Clinton is accountable and needs to be responsive to an entirely different set of incentives and structures. Now, that's a structural argument that has nothing to do with your personal feelings about Hillary Clinton. And it's, in fact, the most important analysis for going into how you choose to vote in terms of reality. And that includes the whole picture. Because no doubt she also has, you know, and you see in her transition team, you have some great progressive people. In her policy proposals, she has some very, very smart and good ideas on public option, expanding Social Security, college affordability. Those are great things. And, you know, you have Ken Salazar, and you have not, you know, dismissing goals that certainly could be achieved with just structural reform. So that's basically it. And I just to add to that, though, this notion of her sort of shape-shifting, how could this be treated as some big shocking revelation? She basically said the same thing the whole primary. And this is where the fixation on Hillary Clinton gets annoying. I think you need to just have a realistic and objective assessment of who she is. She is center left to center right. She's very smart. She's competent. And she's running on a significantly more liberal platform than anything her husband proposed in the 90s, and certainly than how she ran in 2008. In her record overall, there's a lot of things not to like. There's also some things to admire and like as well. She said in the primary that she was a realistic pragmatist who wanted to deliver steady progress and didn't believe in radical structural change. And she just said that in the fundraiser. So where is the big news here? You know, people are on this like constant hunt to find this smoking gun. You know what? If she had went to the fundraiser and she was like, you know, I can't wait so we can have a human body parts exchange, and I can implement a purge so I can watch the poor kill each other for entertainment, I would say that that would be something of a revelation. and probably not exactly synchronized with how she was campaigning. But in fact, that snippet, as much as I disagree substantively, as much as, you know, I find her arguments to be sort of fundamentally historically uncompelling, I think that that's great. It, you know, the constant rap is that she's untrustworthy and blah, blah, blah. She said exactly, behind closed doors, what she campaigned on. Not rocket science here. We will get to rocket science in a moment, but first I need to tell you about another important service. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting a job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want the perfect hire, you need to post all of your post your job to all the top job sites. And now you can with ZipRecruiter.com. You can post the job up to 100 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find a candidate in any city or industry nationwide just once. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. We'll get back to that Bernie stuff in a second. But of course, we have the other salient thing to remember about the election, which is that there is a choice between two options. And yes, there are these other candidates. There's the guy who, you know, can't name a single foreign leader and wants to privatize everything, but somehow is and implement vicious austerity, but somehow has convinced people that he's like an affable pothead, which maybe he is. Maybe Gary Johnson's an affable pothead. And then Jill Stein, you know, I'm actually going to talk about this for a second. We haven't attacked or really criticized Jill Stein on this show at all, or very, very minimally. And, you know, fundamentally, I think, yeah, like if I did one of those, you know, internet tests on what do my politics line up with the best, I probably almost certainly would share the most in common with Jill Stein. I think some of the things that she's campaigning on and talking about in terms of a Green New Deal, I even think some of the things that her vice presidential running mate, people have kind of latched on to certain things he said that are really controversial and written that are controversial, but actually he's also written some very compelling and interesting things. But the problem is look, number one, in terms of reality, she's obviously not going to win. And we've already been through that aspect of how do you actually build a third party? And it's not by having absolutely no electoral presence anywhere in the country, and then every 4 years running symbolic bids that get 2% of the vote. It's useless. Sorry. But if you're going to run a symbolic campaign, you should at least be articulating a theory of change that makes sense, because it's not enough to just come out and show that you're the most left wing and you have the best politics, because I don't, you know, that's not a surprise to anybody who's at a certain point in the political spectrum. I have no doubt, as I say, that I share a lot of Jill Stein's politics, and she's, you know, a good person and doing things for noble reasons. Great. She's going to lose. And she has an opportunity to have a little bit of media time to articulate something. Okay. And maybe part of it is to say, no, there's really genuinely progressive and left-wing alternatives here. Okay, that could have some value. But then you need to articulate a theory of change. Now, and that's part of the problem, is I think an actual durable, realistic theory of change that could come from the Green Party would come from doing precisely the opposite of what they're doing. come from having, you know, several dozen credible candidates running a school board race, a mayoral race, a house race, and explaining that theory of change. But all it's really turned into is just like an act of moral self-actualization through voting. And that is just, you know, voting is not the place for moral self-actualization. And even a lot of, you know, the irony is too that even a lot of the sort of space that people draw from to make that argument about, you know, voting your conscience and all of this comes from, you know, discourse that people connect with people like Martin Luther King Jr. or Gandhi, who were in fact both incredibly shrewd and effective political operatives and quite willing to make political trade-offs. And of course, act from conscience. But, you know, Jill Stein is out dangerously coming close to making the case that there's no real discernible difference between Hillary and Trump, which is ludicrous. And you can hate both of them and object to both of them. That's fine. But if you think you're talking about the same person there, it's just not credible. And then making unattached to that a moral argument about, you know, not voting out of fear, and if people say this, then they're not respecting your conscience. I mean, it's not about you, and it's not an effective theory of change. And Donald Trump, though, does have a very effective way of doing his taxes. And we know, we saw in the leaks to the New York Times that came out over the weekend. And guys, do you know, baseless speculation, but what was the address on the envelope that Donald Trump's 1995 leaked tax form came from? Where was it sent from?
Well, the return address was listed as Trump Tower.
I mean, either I did it or I have a mole. Or maybe I have a mole inside myself.
Or maybe it's just possible that maybe one of my employees is unhappy with me.
Which would just be bizarre because, I mean, I do a great job. Just the other day, I told the woman that she looked like a disgusting pig and I offered to stand next to her and insult her while she worked out on a treadmill. And I mean, I'm in the middle of running for president. I thought that was incredibly generous of me. But, or, you know, the other possibility is that Donald Trump's super ego is somehow operating on its own. And so, like, when he finally crashes, like at 4 a.m. after like tweeting and eating meatloaf and like watching 20 different channels and calling up to berate one of his kids or pretending that he's not available to talk to Tiffany. When he finally crashes and falls asleep, then his superego takes over his body and his superego is just like, I can't be president. I'll start a global war. Let me go send my tax forms to the New York Times. It might save the country. Yeah, but basically, I mean, no surprise here. What we found, according to these filings that were leaked to the New York Times, is that in 1995, Donald Trump basically claimed a loss of $916 million. And he was. His airline had gone bankrupt. He was taking major losses at his casinos and various other business ventures because fundamentally Donald Trump is a trust fund baby and not a good businessman. He's decent at sales. He's a reality TV star. That's what he's good at. He's not good at business. And he's good at not good. Sad. He's good at manipulating the process, and of course, everybody went out, and you can check out, you know, his Twitter timeline, because in classic Republican fashion, while he set up a system where he literally, with claiming that kind of loss, might not have paid an income tax for decades, and of course, he's still out on Twitter saying, people are abusing the system. They're abusing welfare. And once again, Donald Trump becomes, in his own unique, perverse, disgusting way, the perfect Republican. Because what has he done? He's basically said that there's one set of rules that applies to the ultra wealthy or the pretend ultra wealthy. They can exploit and abuse every loophole imaginable. And then these, you know, undocumented workers who probably put more into America's tax system than he does and undoubtedly do more for overall American ingenuity, they need to have their lives destroyed so that he can run a clown fascist presidential campaign. And a discussion of clown fascism would not be complete without the very disgusting, very clown fascist, very makes Donald Trump almost look good, very racist, very fundamentally horrible human being, former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, who's going to go on ABC News this week with George Stephanopoulos and make this case about Donald Trump gaming the tax system.
And now we're joined by Mr. Trump's advisor, former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani. Thank you for coming in again.
Hi, Mr. George. Mayor. Good morning.
So what's your response to this story?
My response is he's a genius. I mean, the reality
genius?
Is absolute genius. I mean, the man in the art of the deal, this is described. First of all, we're talking about 26 years ago, perfectly legal. We should get that straight immediately. This is a perfectly legal application of the tax code. And he would have been a fool not to take advantage of it. Not only that, he would have probably breached his fiduciary duty to his investors, to his business. You have an obligation when you run a business to maximize the profits. And if there is a tax law that says I can deduct this, you deduct it.
I don't know about the maximizing profits section of Trump's various enterprises. But I will say this. If you think that Donald Trump and his people have a secret plan to bring back manufacturing jobs to the Midwest, and they're tired of the system being rigged against you, and they want to actually do something for you, look at those tax returns and take a good look at one of Donald Trump's closest advisors. Because we don't even have the sheen with these people. You know, if you listen to a guy like Mitt Romney, as delusional and plutocratic as he is, there is some part of him that actually thinks he's playing by a rule book that might benefit everybody. There's no pretense of this with these people. They want to scam you, and he's telegraphing it in real time. There's no difference, and I said a long time ago, Trump University is Republican economics in miniature. And they are saying it to your faces. Do you think Rudy Giuliani would appreciate the acumen of a undocumented worker who's been here and successfully raised a family and contributed to the tax code? I don't think so. Unless they could serve as a backdrop for a racist joke about Mexican maids at a speaking engagement, which also happened this weekend, apparently. These people are really terrible. They could almost make anybody talk like Judy Gold.
They're doing a great job at discrediting capitalism, too.
Yeah, they are. Like, they are.
It's the law. It's capitalism's law that you have to maximize profit. Like, I wonder why millennials hate capitalism so much.
Yeah, I wonder why they're in their basements admiring noble old Jewish socialists.
Yeah, meanwhile, the student
watching
loan...
Watching YouTube shows. Yeah.
The student loan deduction is capped at like $2,500.
Yeah, well, you need to be accountable for the decisions you make, unless those decisions involve inheriting millions of dollars and creating a fake casino and hotel empire and getting ferried around on a private jet by a convicted cocaine trafficker. Then you're a genius. And the thing is that this is what these people believe. They think you are fundamentally less than them. And if you reward that, you are. Because you are the ultimate mark. The ultimate sucker. We got to get to the fun half. We're going to try to figure out if the phones will get working. I don't know what the problem is. The IMs are on. A lot more sound to get to, and we'll talk about this interview with President Obama that Jonathan Chait did Subscribe to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I think now we're at like 125 reviews and 200 rankings, which is great. People are enjoying the show. Subscribe in iTunes. It helps this show. It helps grow everything. Even if you're a member of the Majority Report, subscribe to the Majority Report in iTunes because it helps the ranking of this show, and consider giving the Majority Report an iTunes review and ranking. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Check out the sponsors of today's show. What else should we mention? Become a member of the Majority Report, majority.fm/become a member. This show is fundamentally supported by its listeners. No show tomorrow, but we will be doing live coverage of the vice presidential debate.
We have a pre-recorded show tomorrow.
A little live show tomorrow. Pre-record with Jay Rosen, I believe. Jay Rosen, pre-record tomorrow. And then starting, I believe, I don't know the time, but we'll post it. We're doing live coverage of tomorrow's vice presidential debate. Big league.